So we're at the tail end of Habakkuk, and we've come to the end today. A couple of weeks ago we saw Habakkuk asking that question, why doesn't God do something, and wondering why God wasn't listening. And so we saw him challenging God. We saw that everything around him sucked. He saw that God didn't seem to be doing anything. And when God told him that he had a truly amazing plan, he didn't like that plan. And so he told God that that didn't work, and that sucked as well, using the Babylonians to wipe out his country. Habakkuk couldn't have known that God was going to turn bad into good, but he knew he could engage honestly with God because he was secure in his relationship with God. And then last week we saw that Habakkuk mellowed a little bit. He patiently waited for God to respond to his complaints and his questions, and God did. God graciously explained to Habakkuk that pride and idols often cause people to act badly. But despite this, God assured Habakkuk that he's in control and worth hanging on to. Today we're going to do a little bit more thinking about this question. Why doesn't God do something? There's a temptation that we have to think that God's good because of the way that we can see his blessings. Lots of things going well for us. So if we've got health and we've got a good job, and our family's doing us proud, and we're well off financially, then we feel blessed. And because we feel blessed, we deduce from that that God must be good. But there must be a way to work out how God's good, even when we can't see the evidence for that in our lives. Because if God's really good, he must be good, even if we don't have health, or we've got a rotten job, or a dysfunctional family, or perhaps no family at all. God must be good even when we can't pay the rent. In today's passage, Habakkuk tells us he will rejoice even in those times. Last week, Luke read to us from 1 Thessalonians 5, which says to rejoice always, to pray continually, to give thanks in all circumstances. We're to rejoice always, even in tough times. So rejoicing can't simply mean just feeling happy. It doesn't make sense, I don't think it's even sane, to be happy during tough times. We can't possibly be happy all the time. So learning what rejoicing is and how to do it in hard times is what this chapter is about. It seems that Habakkuk found a way, because at the end of the chapter he says, and by the way, this is the New International Reader's Version, which I understand a lot better than some of the other versions. The fig tree might not bud, the vines might not produce any grapes, the olive crop might fail, the fields might not produce any food, there might not be any sheep in the pens, there might not be any cattle in the barns, but I will still be glad because of what the Lord has done. God, my Saviour, fills me with joy. Habakkuk's moved from asking God why he doesn't do anything in chapter 1 to now saying that he'll rejoice in the Lord, even though he's facing no figs and no grapes, and therefore no wine, no olives, no olive oil, no olive bread, no wheat, no rice, no barley, no oats, no sheep for meat, no cattle for steaks. In other words, no food at all. So facing the real possibility of starvation now, surprisingly, Habakkuk doesn't ask God why he isn't doing anything. Instead, he intends to rejoice in his suffering. Not because of his suffering, but in the middle of his suffering, he's going to rejoice. I've never had to starve, but it doesn't look like something that you do to be happy. To find out how Habakkuk comes to rejoice in the middle of hardship, we need to work out how the threads of the last couple of chapters come together. We see the need for humility last week, the damaging effects of pride and idols, an awareness of God's love and goodness even in the tough times. And this chapter shows us how Habakkuk came to understand, firstly, how it's possible to rejoice in suffering, and secondly, where real hope can be found, and finally, what the reason for that real hope is. Firstly, how it's possible to rejoice in suffering. Verse 19 describes being in a place of peace, of confidence, of contentment, almost euphoria, because of a focus on God. The Lord and King gives me strength. He makes my feet like the feet of a deer. He helps me to walk on the highest places. Obviously, the image is of a sure-footed deer walking on a treacherous mountaintop. I'm still amazed by Alex Honnold's 2017 free climb of El Capitan in Yosemite National Park. Without ropes or any aids at all, he climbed the 884 metres in 3 hours and 56 minutes. There he is, no ropes, no harness, no safety net, nearly a kilometre above the ground. It's not a stuntman on a movie set with a safety net underneath him, it's a real person on a real mountain, a real long way from the ground. So mountains can be dangerous places. I find footpaths quite challenging, even treacherous at times. Honnold's feet, his calm confidence in his planning, his ability to focus and keep going despite danger, all combined to create a context for rejoicing. Because after the climb, he said in an interview, "I still love soloing, and I've been doing it a fair amount, but after achieving that life dream with El Cap, nothing is calling to me quite as much as it did. There's literally nothing else like it in the world." And that's what I've been struggling with. When you know that nothing you do in the future will ever matter as much as what you've already done, it takes a little steam out of you. The difficulty of Honnold's feat pushed him literally to the heights. He rejoiced in that difficulty, in that achievement, so much so that he feels like he'll never experience it ever again. When suffering comes, it either pushes us to the heights or it pushes us over the edge. Tough times can make us softer or harder. It can make us empathetic or bitter and cynical. It can make us humble or arrogant, fragile or resilient. Sweet or sour. Tough times can make us better or worse. The Lord and King gives me strength. He makes my feet like the feet of a deer, and He helps me walk on the highest places. Being close to God, finding His strength in Him and His joy in Him and not His circumstances, was how Habakkuk trod the dangerous heights as a sure-footed deer and was able to rejoice. As Habakkuk realised how it's possible to rejoice in the midst of suffering, he also discovered hope in the midst of suffering. Verse 16. I listened and my heart pounded. My lips trembled at the sound. My bones seemed to rot and my legs shook. But I'll be patient. I'll wait for the day of trouble to come on Babylon. It's the nation that is attacking us. Habakkuk still doesn't feel good about the Babylonian invasion. Apparently, the literal translation of the beginning of the verse is, I heard and my bowels trembled, not my heart pounded. Think about that for a moment. There might be a colloquial Australian expression which comes to mind for bowels trembling. So he doesn't feel good, but his hope in the middle of the tough times is that Babylon will get what it deserves. His legs are shaking, he's about to burst into tears, he's not in a good place, but he makes a conscious decision to be patient, even though his circumstances haven't changed, and even though the Babylonians are knocking at the door. And of course he'd like things to be different, and instead of becoming more and more frustrated and angry about something he can't change, he's at peace because of a conscious decision to find hope. to rest in the hope that God would act, that the Babylonians would get what they deserve, even though there'd be much grief and suffering and struggling along the way. So Habakkuk rejoices in the midst of his suffering because of his focus on God, and he finds hope in the eventual destruction of the Babylonians. And finally, he reassures himself of that hope by reflecting on what God has done. I'm not exactly sure what Habakkuk's talking about in a lot of the other verses in the chapter. There seem to be some references to creation, to some of the battles that were fought against the nations when they came to the Promised Land. But there are definitely echoes of some of the events around the Exodus, when God rescued his people from Egypt. Have a look at verse 5, for example. He sent plagues ahead of him, sickness followed behind him. Exodus 9 describes how the Egyptians and their animals were covered in boils. And Exodus 10 describes the locust plague, which covered the ground until it was black. And then again in verse 6, when he stood up, the earth shook. When he looked at the nations, they trembled with fear. Exodus 19 says that when Moses went up to receive the Ten Commandments, Mount Sinai trembled violently, and everyone camped there trembled as well. And then in verse 15, your horses charged into the Red Sea. They stirred up the great waters. Exodus 14 describes how God divided the waters of the Red Sea and flattened them with a strong east wind. Habakkuk remembered how God had acted in the past, especially in saving his people when they couldn't save themselves. That gave him good reason for the hope that he had in verse 16, that God would act in the future. Habakkuk didn't know it, but the bad that he was facing in chapter 1 would turn into good. The Jews spreading throughout Asia provided lots of strongholds for the gospel later on. In the first couple of chapters, Habakkuk knew that the good relationship he had with God could never be taken away. And then in this chapter, Habakkuk realises the best is yet to come as he looks back on what God's done and hopes for Babylon's demise in the future. Bad turning to good, good not being taken away, the best yet to come, gave Habakkuk reasons to rejoice. Habakkuk realised that God was doing something, even if it didn't involve changing his immediate circumstances. When things look bad for us, like Habakkuk, we want to know why God isn't doing something to make our lives easier, something to fix what's going on. And like Habakkuk, we probably won't find the answers that we want, and maybe not even answers we like. So I guess when we ask the question, why doesn't God do something, what we're really asking is, why doesn't God make things better for us? When I was teaching, parent interviews were sometimes pretty tricky. I couldn't help noticing the accusations sometimes behind the questions that I was asked. For example, a particularly tricky question was the one which went a bit like this. Why haven't you helped my son finish their project on time? I found it really difficult to answer that question without getting defensive. I heard that the implication was that I hadn't done anything, that it was my fault that the son hadn't finished his project. But if I was asked a different question, if I was asked what I'd done to help finish the project, I didn't feel like I was being attacked so much. I could talk about the jigs that I'd made, I could talk about the offers of extra time at lunchtime and after school, I could talk about how I'd moved him to the other side of the room to stop him chatting to his mates so much. It was much easier to have a discussion around the things that I'd done, whether they were appropriate, which things worked better than others, what I could be doing differently next time. We could have a useful conversation. Likewise, Habakkuk's journey in seeking an answer to the question, why doesn't God do something, has shown us a better question to ask. Habakkuk moved from asking God why he wasn't doing anything to asking himself, what's God done? In hard times, perhaps that's a better question for us to ask. Because when we ask what God's done, it's much easier for us to get answers. And when we get them, like Habakkuk, we're more likely to realise that we're okay, even when the answers to that other question aren't clear or impossible to work out. By recalling the events around the Exodus and the other ways that God had acted, Habakkuk reminded himself that God had acted in the past to rescue his people. And we have an Exodus rescue story as well, a better one. When God didn't just act in the world from outside the world, but he entered into the world in history, in the person of Jesus. In the first Exodus, Moses risked his life so God could rescue his people from the bondage of slavery. But in our Exodus, Jesus gave his life so that God could rescue his people from the bondage of sin. In the first Exodus, lambs were slain and blood sprinkled on the doorposts. But in our Exodus, Jesus himself was the lamb. After the first Exodus, the names of the 12 tribes were engraved on some rocks and the high priest wore them into the holy place. But in our Exodus, Jesus is our high priest at God's right hand, and our names are written on his heart in the book of life. In our culture, we're told that you can't have rejoicing in the middle of suffering, that pain's bad, should be gotten rid of, that we deserve comfort and all the good things that life has to offer. And the result is that we spend our lives either in foolish optimism, thinking nothing will ever go wrong for us and everything has a solution, and this causes us to rejoice in things which won't last. And then when the wheels fall off, when things go wrong, as they will, we fall into dark depression and pessimism, thinking that this isn't the way the world was meant to be. Nothing ever goes right for us. There's no hope. And things get really bad. Sometimes we want to check out. Flipping between foolish optimism and foolish pessimism. Apologies if you've heard the story of two young brothers, one a foolish optimist, the other a foolish pessimist. One Christmas, the parents decided the optimist needed taking down a bit and the pessimist needed building up. So Christmas Eve, they filled every available space in the pessimist's room with toys. And they filled every available space in the optimist's room with horse manure. Come Christmas morning, they heard loud wailing and sobs coming from the pessimist's room, and wondering what was wrong, they opened the door and found him sitting in the middle of all his toys, sobbing his eyes out, sobbing his heart out. "What's wrong?" they asked. And he said, "This is terrible. If I live to be 100, I'll never have enough time to play with all these toys." And the parents then heard laughing and whistling coming from the optimist room, the one full of horse manure. And they went to see what was going on there. They found him covered with the stuff, sitting in the middle of it, up to his arms, all over his face. And he said, scooping around, he said, "This is awesome," he said. "There must be a horse in here somewhere." When things are going well for us, we're foolishly optimistic to think that that's normal. And when things go badly for us, we're foolishly pessimistic to think that there's no hope. And Jesus says exactly that in John 16. "I've told you these things so that you can have peace because of me. In this world, you will have trouble, but be encouraged. I have won the battle over the world." Things will go wrong in the world, and when they do, there's real cause for hope because Jesus has won the battle over the world. Rejoicing and sorrow can coexist in the middle of hardship because the ability to rejoice takes place within the hardship, not because of the hardship, and not because it replaces the hardship. In the midst of starvation, Habakkuk was able to take heart and rejoice by reminding himself of what God has done. We know God's good because of what he's done. We know that bad things are working for good We know that the good, the forgiveness on offer through Jesus and the adoption as sons and daughters can never be taken away from us. And we know that the best is yet to come, a time when there'll be no more suffering, no more tears, no more pain. Some of us are going through really tough times at the moment, where there's probably no relief in this life. Others are going through really tough times at the moment, but they'll get better. And some of us are struggling with things that aren't so tough, but still difficult. And still others have no idea what we've been talking about, because things are going all tickety-boo, and we've no idea of the struggles and the tough times waiting just around the corner. We're always going to be tempted to ask God why he isn't doing something to make life easier. And it's okay to ask the question. When we ask, God may well answer that question in ways that are tangible and relevant to our circumstances. Or you might just remember to read Habakkuk again, which could be a nudge from God saying, I've had this conversation already. Don't ask me what I'm doing. Ask me what I've done. That is enough. Let's pray. Father, you've shown in the past you're capable and powerful to act in the world from outside and from within the world through the person of your Son. Please help us remember these things during tough times, to remember that you're worthy of trust no matter what we're going through. Help us to rejoice in the knowledge that you will act again, if not by changing our circumstances, then one day by fixing everything so that there's no more tears, no more sickness, hardship or death. Help us remember the best is yet to come because of what you've done in the past. Thanks for causing Habakkuk to write these things down. Thanks for preserving these words over the centuries and for bringing such a relevant message to us today. You're so kind to us. Amen.